The greatest scientific breakthroughs of the 20th century, and certainly the most controversial, was the development of nuclear physics. Harnessing the enigmatic qualities of the atom's tiny core brought us nuclear power and gave us the bomb, a breakthrough with such far-reaching consequences that it moved the physicist Albert Einstein to say, "Had I known, I should have become a watchmaker." How can such outlandish power be released from such infinitesimal amounts of matter? And what does the science of the nucleus tell us about how our universe is built? Nuclear technology provokes strong emotional and political reactions, but what are the plain facts behind its development as a science? With me to discuss the development of nuclear physics is Jim Al-Khalili, senior lecturer in physics at the University of Surrey and author of Nucleus, A Trip into the Heart of Matter. Christine Sutton, particle physicist and lecturer in physics at St. Catherine's College, Oxford, author of Spaceship Neutrino. And John Gribbin, visiting fellow in astronomy at the University of Sussex and author of Q is for Quantum and In Search of Schrödinger's Cat. John Gribbin, can we begin with a brief outline of how an atom is arranged? What do we know about its constituent parts?
We know that it's mostly empty space. I think that's the most staggering thing about it. There's a very, very tiny nucleus that contains virtually all of its mass, and that's surrounded by a cloud of electrons, which have very little mass indeed, with a lot of space between them. So something that seems really solid and physically sound, like the table that we're sitting at, is mostly empty space, tiny particles held together by electric forces.
Can you tell me what an atom is? I mean, what can we see it? What does it look like? What does it imagine like? What analogies would you bring to bear?
It's just about possible to not see but image atoms these days using modern technology. You can get a picture on a computer screen of something which represents the atom that you're scanning in some way. But they're far too small to be seen by conventional optical microscopes or to pick up with tweezers or anything like that. There are billions and billions of particles inside any tiny amount of everyday matter. They're very, very small. They're held together by these electric forces. And they really are like nothing that we experience in the everyday world.
The Greek philosophers like Democritus and Epicurus talked about atoms, but they had an idea of atoms being rather like ping pong balls.
Yes, they did. Now, that's much more like a solid object. See, they would have imagined an atom as something solid that was indestructible, couldn't be subdivided. And the great difference that the 20th century physicists brought out from the study of atoms and the study of the nucleus is this idea that it's divisible, that there are pieces within atoms that can be chipped off and broken away, and also this idea that it's far from being solid, that it's an empty space containing forces.
Before we go into the sort of history of how that came about, why is that significant?
It's significant both because it's pure knowledge. I mean, we probe the structure of matter to find out what's there, the same as the Greeks were interested out of pure knowledge. And nobody at the time imagined practical consequences like nuclear fission, providing energy, providing bombs, and so on. People just did it because it's there. That's the old tradition of science.
Would you say that the modern interest in our knowledge of nuclear physics could reasonably be said to have started with the British physicist J.J. Thomson in the late 19th century, in the 1890s.
Well, sitting here in London, we can reasonably say that. I think there are people on the continent who would point the finger at Philip Lennard, who did similar work at the same time. But yes, during the 1890s, it was realised that pieces could be chipped off atoms, and those pieces were electrons, and that's what Thomson is credited with discovering, is the electron. And the astonishing discovery then, when he made the announcement to the scientific community that it was possible to divide the atom, people didn't believe him. People who believed in atoms believed that they were indestructible according to the Greek model, and it's very hard for us to appreciate now what a dramatic breakthrough it was to find that you could knock bits off atoms.
How did you find out that you could knock bits off atoms?
It was through... It all depends on technology. This is an interesting feature of how science develops. You can't make progress until you've got technology to do new tricks. And the technology was actually the vacuum pump. It was something as simple as that, having better pumps which made it possible to make empty glass vessels, vacuum tubes, and then you had electricity pass through wires inside there, so-called cathodes, which emit electrons, and you found out from these studies that the pieces were coming off the atoms and the pieces were negatively charged particles.
So from being, as it were, a Greek ping pong ball, the atom begat a different image, didn't it, through Thomson?
Yes, I mean the image.
A very Victorian image.
It changed over the years. I mean, at first people thought that it was still a kind of a solid object, you know, with the electrons embedded in it. And an analogy that was sometimes made is like with a plum pudding or with a raisin pudding, and that these little pieces could get knocked out. And then over a period of 20 years or so, it became appreciated that, as we said earlier, that there is this tiny central nucleus and the electrons outside.
But let's say the plum pudding, which is very sort of hobbitish and Tolkienish and so on, very Victorian that they should make a plum pudding. So that's what Thomson arrived at with the electrons.
Yes.
There was this spongy material and with the raisins.
Little bits inside.
Yeah. Christine Sutton, the plum pudding model of the atom was turned around by Ernest Rutherford's experiments at the end of the first decade of the 20th century. Can you tell us how he approached it and how he, as it were, developed that?
Well, again, it was something that was discovered partly through the available technology and just through pursuing curiosity. I mean, Rutherford was at Manchester. He had been earlier at Cambridge when radioactivity was first discovered. And radioactivity is a natural phenomenon that emits various kinds of, as we know now, bits of atom. But of course, if you didn't know that you could make bits of atom, nobody knew that at the end of the 19th century, that that's what was going on with radioactivity. And there were a particular kind of a bit of the atom that's called an alpha particle. And Rutherford really made these alpha particles his own, in the sense that as soon as he'd discovered them, he started using them as tools. So he did the exciting thing of turning the alpha particles back on the atoms.
What's an alpha particle?
Well, we now know an alpha particle is the nucleus, the core of an atom of helium. Next to the lightest element of matter. Hydrogen's the lightest element, helium's the next lightest. And this core, this nucleus, happens to be a very, very stable form of nucleus that holds together and can be thrown out of heavier materials like uranium or thorium or these exotic things.
How did he use it? How did he discover that it could be useful?
I think because he realized that he discovered that these things could travel through a certain amount of matter, that they had quite a lot of energy, and so it became interesting to see what happened when they went through matter. And it was in trying to look at what happened when they went through matter that he made his dramatic discoveries in Manchester.
But how do you see all this in 1911? I mean, you've got track an alpha particle? He knows about alpha particles. Presumably he has to kind of make it up because he can't see them. But what happens next?
What happens is when an alpha particle hits a material, a particular kind of material, the material will emit a little flash of light. And what these guys had to do was to sit in a pitch black room with their source of alpha particles pointing at something, and then they were looking at what happened, say when it went through the thing, like very thin gold foil, or when it was bounced back, say, so you know, like hitting a tennis ball at a wall and seeing it come back. And when it comes back and hits your material, which is called scintillator, which emits the little flashes of light, you see the flash of light, so you count it. So, and they were literally counting the flashes of light on their detector.
I'm not quite clear about this. So how do they know? They're sitting in this darkened room, Rutherford and his colleagues. How do they know this stuff's coming off as alpha particle? What's it coming off? It's coming off some kind of radium.
Yeah,
but they know it's coming off. And they've got this gold foil. Now, what, as I understand, it took them by surprise that some of the particles went right through. Mm-hmm. Some of them were deflected slightly, but some, most significantly, for this brief history, bounced straight back. Now, what did that signify, and why was that a surprise?
Well, it is a surprise because the foil, they knew that most of the particles would go through it, and that's what they expected, because the foil was very, very, very thin. I don't know if you've ever, most of us haven't actually touched gold foil. It's very sort of funny, sticky, weird stuff, which is very, very thin. You know, you're talking about something that's, you know, not many atoms thick, that the alpha particles are going through. Most of them would go through. Some were slightly deflected. Now, he knew that these alpha particles were really quite energetic. And, you know, like you can imagine firing tennis balls from Pete Sampras at tissue paper hanging up. You'd expect these things just to go whacking through. And the fact that he knew that they were deflected backwards meant that there had to be some powerful forces at work inside the atom, much more powerful than he'd imagined. And to be fair, it took him a year or so to go away and think about what is actually happening here. And the reason why this led to the idea of a different concept of the atom was in trying to understand how these forces are at work inside the atom, because the only force people knew about was the electric force that John mentioned earlier. So they had to understand what was going on inside the atom in terms of the electric force there, because we knew that the bits of John mentioned the negative electrons, there had to be positives to cancel the negatives, and he had to work out where that positiveness was and how that bounced your alpha particles around.
Jim Al-Khalili, can you take up this history now? So what does that signify? We're talking about 1912, and where do we go from there? Can you summarise that stage? Tell us what that signifies, and then move us on from there.
Well, until then, as John mentioned, there was this Thompson plum pudding model of the atom, where it was assumed the electrons were distributed throughout the whole space of the atom.
Like the raisins and plums.
That's right. But the alpha particles that were hitting the atoms were thousands of times more massive than the electrons. So Rutherford knew these alpha particles weren't going to bounce back after hitting the electrons. The only possible way that any of the alpha particles could bounce back was if most of the mass of the atom was concentrated in a very, very tiny volume. So he suggested that maybe the electrons, which you can completely ignore in terms of the alpha particle experiment, were floating around the outside, but most of the positive charge, which he knew had to balance the negative charge of the electrons to make an atom electrically neutral, most of that, all that positive charge had to be concentrated in a very tiny volume, and that then became the atomic nucleus.
So he discovered the atomic nucleus.
Yes, so his model was then this solar system model of the atom, where the nucleus was like the sun and the electrons were like the orbiting planets.
So what did that signify? Where did that take you, physicists, in terms of what this opened up as a subject, in terms of John Griffin's idea of pure knowledge, but also in terms of what it might lead to?
Well, we have to remember, at the same time, another theory was being developed called quantum theory, which suggested that down at this very tiny length scale, things behaved very, very differently. And of course, when people thought about Rutherford's model of the atom, the big problem was, how did these negative electrons orbit around the nucleus without being sucked in due to the attractive positive force?
Yes, the nucleus is positive and they're negative. They're supposed to attract, and therefore it should collapse in.
I remember that quickly from form physics.
Yes.
Yes, they didn't. They didn't.
So why didn't they?
Well, at this point, the Danish physicist Niels Bohr came in. He'd gone to work with Rutherford. He was interested in Rutherford's model of the atom. And he applied the then very new rules of quantum theory to show how an atom could remain stable. So he suggested that these electrons followed fixed orbits around the atom. There were certain quantum rules that stopped them from jumping, from spiraling into the atom. They would only change from one orbit to the other according to certain very strict quantum rules. And so he gave atoms stability.
What I'm really fascinated by, it comes back to John Gribbin's remark at the very top of the program about the development of this subject being associated with the development of technology. How did they find out about this? How did they track it? How did they see? What instruments are they using for measurement?
Well,
we're talking about the beginning of the 20th century. First two or three decades.
It was very, very crude experiments. As Christine mentioned, they had to sit in darkened rooms for hours upon hours, getting their eyes adjusted to the dark, just to see the tiny flashes of light on scintillation screens. They developed special counters, the Geiger counters, which would give off a click every time a subatomic particle, like an alpha particle, entered in them. But a lot of these ideas were theoretical ideas, that they knew an atom had to be stable, atoms exist. And if atoms had this structure of electrons orbiting around a nucleus, there had to be certain rules that allowed them to be stable.
I mean, we're talking about imagination in a way, aren't
Absolutely,
we?
Absolutely, yes.
Imagination, illustrating your imagination.
Yes.
And all the models, as John said in one of his articles, about these models and ideas and analogies we have, which are very useful but never yes. can be accurate.
Well, of course, the other thing is that because the atom and its nucleus are subject to the rules of quantum mechanics, these are very, very strange concepts. And we can't picture We learn at school that the atom is this nucleus with electrons buzzing around the outside, but of course that's not an accurate picture of what an atom is really like. We can't imagine what an atom is really like because it's something so far from our everyday experience. And so we can really only describe it using mathematics. We all physicists have pictures of what things look like.
But it is very well grounded in observations. I mean, this business about electrons jumping from one orbit as if the Earth was jumping from, you know, our orbit to the orbit of Mars or something, it matches up beautifully with something that was already known, which is spectroscopy. And when a hot object radiates light, it does so at very precise wavelengths, and it makes a kind of a fingerprint in the rainbow spectrum of light. It sometimes and made an analogy with a barcode, that kind of pattern. And the great thing about Bohr's work was that, yes, it was imagination, and he had bright ideas and thought about this, but when you used his imaginative model to calculate where the lines ought to be in the spectrum, lo and behold, they were in exactly the places that people already knew about. So it's, you know, it's imagination, but constrained by comparison with the real world as well.
Can I move on to talk about, or can you move on, to talk about the power of fission here? Jim Al-Khalidi, iron is the most stable nucleus of all, I've read, of all the elements, with a total of 56 protons and neutrons. That seems to be very significant, iron 56. Can you tell us why that's significant in the story of nuclear fission?
Well, the nuclear stability is a very complicated area of study, because the way a nucleus holds together is subject to a very complicated force. The strong nuclear force that holds the constituents of a nucleus together is very complicated, and that's why we're still trying to understand it today.
You don't understand it yet?
We know a lot about it, but we don't know everything about it. And so it's...
What do you know that you can tell us that we would understand? Well, that I would understand.
Well, protons and neutrons are the two types of particles that make up a nucleus. And protons are positively charged, neutrons are neutral, so they don't attract each other via electrical forces. They attract each other via this strong nuclear force, a force that only acts within the confines of the nucleus. And so a strong enough nuclear force will hold the protons and neutrons together. But if you get a nucleus that's too big, then protons on either side of the nucleus will only feel their mutual repulsive electrical force, because the strong nuclear force has the property that it only acts over a very short range, not even across the whole span of a large nucleus.
So strong nuclear force is really, this nuclear strong force is a law to itself so far, isn't it?
It's one of the four fundamental forces.
Well, where does
iron
come in? Iron's supposed to come in significantly, and I haven't got there yet.
Well, iron happens to have a certain structure. Protons and neutrons hold together according to certain rules. People developed models of the nucleus. For instance, one of the early models was the liquid drop model, where a nucleus was likened to a drop of water, the way it wobbles about. Later, they developed the idea that protons and neutrons follow the same rules that electrons follow in the way they arrange themselves in orbits and shells around in the atom. Protons and neutrons also seem to fit together in shells within the nucleus. And so you have to understand how these shells get filled up according to certain quantum rules, to explain why it is that iron, with a certain number of protons and neutrons, happens to have just the right arrangement to make the most of the strong nuclear force that holds them together.
But something has to, Jim. I mean, it doesn't really matter that it's iron or what the rules are. You've got a trade-off between one force that's trying to hold things together and the electric force that's trying to blow things apart. And if you put enough particles together, if it's big, the electric force is going to win. If it's small, the strong force is going to win. And iron is just in the middle. So something has to be in the middle, and it happens to be iron.
But it wins better. Iron wins better than a small nucleus like carbon, say, because in carbon, a lot of the protons are near the surface of the nucleus, so they don't have other things trying to hold them in. So as John said, it is a trade-off, but you can imagine it almost like a valley where you have a sort of stable bottom with a deepest point in that valley, which is where iron is, the most stable thing. And all the other nuclei that we know about are like on the hills of the valley, and they're all wanting to sort of tumble down into that most stable point.
John Grimmie, nuclear fission was discovered in the 1930s. How did scientists manage to get nuclei to split, and what happened when they did?
It's a development of the original thing that Rutherford and his colleagues were doing, firing alpha particles at atoms and gold foil to see what happened. And as the technology improved and it became possible to accelerate these particles more effectively, bombard other nuclei more effectively, and you had better detectors to measure what was going on, people did more and more experiments until they reached the point where they were firing particles at nuclei, at targets, and what was coming out wasn't those same particles being bounced off or reflected. They were getting debris from having smashed apart the nuclei that the particles were colliding with. It's technology again, more energy going in, so you're able to do more interesting things.
So what did that result in? What happened in the 1930s? They could split the nuclei, so that meant what?
Well, it meant that the nucleus itself is indivisible. Now, we've gone from the stage at the end of the 19th century... And at the end of the 19th century, there's this sort of shattering revelation that the atom is divisible. And then you have the idea that there's a solid nucleus inside the atom. And at first, that was then thought of as being a fundamental entity that couldn't be divided. Now you've reached the stage where you're dividing even the nucleus up into pieces. Now, that tells you in terms of pure knowledge, you know, I'd study the pieces and find out how they join together and then eventually learn how to make use of the energy that's released. But again, it's a great conceptual advance. You know, where does this process stop? Does matter carry on being divided forever and ever? So people were absolutely fascinated by the discovery.
Christine Sutton, why is uranium always used in nuclear fission?
Well, the point I was going to interject with was that on the one hand, the early studies showed that you could, yes, the nucleus is divisible and you can knock lumps out of it, protons, neutrons, alpha particles that we mentioned before. But the big thing with fission is that we talk about actually breaking a big nucleus up into two smaller lumps, you know, just two lumps. And that goes back to my sort of valley analogy, that uranium is at one end of this valley, sort of near the beginning of the valley where the walls are steep. That's a heavy uranium nucleus. When you break it up into two fragments, they're lower down in the bottom of the valley. By going down to the bottom of the valley, you've released a lot of energy. That's one reason why you use uranium. The other reason why you use uranium is that, in fact, to trigger fission, you don't use alpha particles, as John mentioned. You use these neutrons, the things that have no electric charge, and are actually rather tricky to handle. As John said, you needed the technology to know how to deal with these things. But the neutrons, because they have no electric charge, they can sort of infiltrate into a nucleus. There's nothing to sort of repel them and say, go away, you know, you can't come in here. The neutrons just sort of creep in like invisible secret agents or something. And the addition of one neutron upsets that delicate balance between these strong forces and these electric forces that we've talked about. The whole thing about nuclear physics is this competition that's going on between the electric forces that we're familiar with, or more familiar with, and the strong forces that even the physicists feel a bit sort of uncertain about. In uranium, once this little neutron comes in, it can easily trigger the fission reaction and release the energy that we've talked about.
The time of fission, it was an accident that two chemists, Hahn and Strassmann, were studying what happens to uranium when it captures a neutron. And they were looking at the properties of the nucleus that was produced. And they thought it was a nucleus called radium, which was very close to uranium in the periodic table. But what in fact they produced was barium, which is roughly half the mass of uranium. And because they were chemists, they had some very, very clever techniques of studying the chemical properties of the nucleus that was produced. And they realized that what was happening was that uranium was breaking up in two. And it was very soon after, this is 1939, so very soon after that, physicists came up with the idea that if you think of a nucleus like a drop of water, you can stretch it so there's a neck in between and the drop breaks up into two pieces.
Can we stay with this, Jim? The power of nuclear fission comes from a chain reaction, as I understand it, which releases energy trapped in the nuclei. How is that chain reaction set off?
Well, what happens when a uranium nucleus breaks in two by absorbing a neutron is that it also releases several neutrons from within it that existed within it in the first place. Those neutrons then fly off, and if one or more of those is captured by a surrounding uranium nucleus, they might prompt that to undergo fission as well. And so all the time, a neutron causing one uranium nucleus to fission allows another neutron coming out to cause another uranium to fission, you'll get a sustained chain reaction. If more than one of the neutrons within the uranium nucleus causes fission, then you get a runaway chain reaction where more and more, exponentially more and more uranium nuclei will fission, and that's of course what you get in a bomb.
Where does this, Christensen, where does this trapped energy come from?
That's the hard question I was hoping nobody was going to answer. So, I mean, I think the simplest way of thinking about this is that if you broke a uranium nucleus up into all its 200 neutrons and protons, individual pieces, and you weighed each of the protons and neutrons, you would get a total mass for all the building bricks. But when you find out the mass of a uranium nucleus, that mass is different from all those bits added together. And we know from Einstein's theory that mass and energy have an equivalence, E equals mc squared, the only equation in physics that most of us have heard anything about. So E energy, mc squared, the mass. When the uranium breaks up, its mass is changing, and that change in mass comes out as the energy. I mean, I think that's the simplest way. I could talk about binding energy and things like that, but we get into places where my students have trouble following it to begin with.
I suppose it's energy locked up holding the uranium together, but because the uranium is unstable, it very much would prefer to break up into two more stable pieces.
Going back to the valley analogy, we know about hydroelectric power. If water runs down a valley, you get energy coming out because the water's changed its position in the valley.
Uranium is higher.
Uranium has changed its position, and you're releasing energy. But it is related to the mass difference as well.
John Grimmin, what's the difference between in the fundamental nature of the way it comes about between a nuclear reactor and a nuclear bomb?
It's essentially the thing that Jim alluded to. In a nuclear reactor, you're controlling what's going on and you're maintaining a steady reaction. Ideally, for each one uranium nucleus that splits, one more is affected by the neutron that comes off, and so it just keeps going as long as you've got a supply of uranium at a steady rate. And in a bomb, you've got more than one. That's all you need. If it's just two uranium nuclei that are split by the splitting of the first uranium nucleus, then it's 2, 4, 8, and so on. And very quickly, you have a runaway reaction. And so a lot of energy is released very, very quickly. And that's why what you have in nuclear fission reactors, you have some kind of controlling medium to catch neutrons, to stop them doing this. And in some, they're graphite rods. That was the earliest form of moderator, as it's called, that was used. And you can literally push the rods in and out. If your reactor's running a bit too fast, you push the rods in and trap more of the neutrons. And if it's cooling off, you pull them out. And of course, that's what went wrong at Chernobyl. People were playing about with the control system, and they let it get too hot.
So Jim, that's the way to control it in the train reactor, through these graphite rods.
Yes, there are certain elements that prefer to absorb neutrons. Cadmium is an example. It's an element that likes to absorb any extra neutrons. So if you have cadmium in a reactor, then it will make sure that not too many of these neutrons go off and break up more uranium nuclei. The other idea is that you need something to slow down the neutrons, because uranium won't be split up by a very fast neutron.
It'll
bounce off.
Uranium,
It'll bounce off elastically, like a ping pong ball. But you need to slow down the neutron, and what's usually used is water, and it slows down the neutrons down to a speed which makes the uranium nuclei able to absorb them and undergo fission. So there are a number of competing effects to make sure that you maintain this controlled chain reaction where only one each uranium nucleus causes the fission of one other uranium nucleus.
But theoretically, from what you're saying, nuclear fission in terms of creating bombs is limitless.
Well, it's not limitless. I mean, you're always ultimately limited by the amount of mass you've got. I mean, if you were completely annihilated all of the matter, you'd have a very, very big explosion, but it's not absolutely limitless. The great thing about uranium and other materials like that is that you get a lot of energy for a small amount of mass. So there is a finite resource in terms of uranium. People sometimes make a comparison with things like fossil fuel and say fossil fuel is going to run out but uranium isn't. Well, that's wrong, because you can only dig up so much uranium out of the Earth's crust. You can generate power that way for a very long time, but it's not literally limitless.
I'd be interested to know that there's an area in Africa where it's believed that about 2 billion years ago a natural nuclear reactor occurred in the uranium deposits in the rock there.
I am interested. What happened there?
Well, the people discovered when they were mining for uranium that the amounts of the products of fission, you know, the nuclei that you split, the uranium had been split into, were different from what they are in most other uranium deposits around the world. And the hypothesis, which you can then test, is that supposing there were just the right conditions, there was some water around to slow the neutrons down, the neutrons then were absorbed by the natural uranium, and the uranium fissioned. And the calculations suggest that this was really the case, say, about 2 billion years ago. And the amount of energy that came out of it was probably enough to sort of boil a kettle for a week or something. It wasn't a huge amount. We're not talking about...
Well, can we talk about fusion now? In fusion, the nucleus of one atom is fused with the...
Did I say fusion rather than fission? I meant fission.
You meant fission, I know. But can we talk about fusion? In fusion, the nucleus of one atom is fused with the nucleus of another, as I understand, and energy is released. Under what circumstances can nuclei be forced to fuse, be made to fuse?
Under what circumstances can they be made to fuse? Well, in that case, what we're trying to do is to bring... Remember, our nuclei have positive charges on them.
Mm.
They have to overcome that natural repulsion there is. You know, likes repel and likes attract. And so you can either have very sort of energetic nuclei that come together with quite a lot of energy, so the energy that they have overcomes the... natural repulsion. They can get, as long as they can get close together, this strong force that Jim introduced, and John, he mentioned that the strong force is very short range. If you can get the nuclei close enough together so that that short range force locks in, you know, it's a bit like Velcro. Imagine, you know, most of the time when your garments with Velcro and like your waterproofs are, the Velcro is far apart, there's no problem, but you just get it to touch slightly and thump, it snaps in. Well, the strong force is a bit like that. And if you can get that to happen with these nuclei that are lightweight, because now we're talking about going the other side of iron, we're talking about lightweight nuclei that want to get to this bottom of the valley. And the way they do that is by joining together. And again, it has to do with this competition of forces.
How do they do that? I mean, how do you manage to do that, Jim?
Well, it happens around us. This is the reason why the sun shines. What's going on inside the sun is a thermonuclear reaction. So you have light elements, hydrogen, or protons, which are the nuclei of hydrogen, fusing together to make heavier nuclei. First of all, they make heavy hydrogen, deuterium, and then deuterium fuse together to make helium, and so on. This is how the elements are actually produced, the very light elements are produced inside stars. What we'd want to do is try and mimic that reaction in the laboratory on Earth. But what we don't have are the conditions in the centre of the sun, 100 million degrees centigrade. We'd like to have those conditions in the laboratory, because that's the temperature, the energy that we need to push these things close enough together in the first place.
What are the benefits of nuclear fusion going to be? I mean, at the moment what you're saying is that we can't do it well enough.
We're working on it, yeah. But then people working on nuclear fusion have been saying that for a very long time. But if and when they succeed, it has several benefits over nuclear fission, which is the way we produce nuclear power at the moment. First of all, it produces more energy. Secondly, we don't have to rely on a limited supply of uranium. We can make use of water, hopefully, seawater, which is unlimited pretty much. And thirdly, it has the benefits in the fact that it doesn't have, it's a cleaner form of energy. It doesn't have the radioactive waste of the level of nuclear fission.
But there are no nuclear fusion reactors at work in the world at the moment, are there?
Not yet. People working in the field have said for many years now that nuclear fusion is about 40 years away. They've been saying 40 years. What they say now it's 40 years away, but what's different now is that they feel they have a roadmap. They know exactly what they should have achieved 10 years from now, 20 years from now.
And people have actually achieved fusion, but it takes more energy to make things fuse together at the moment than you get out from the reaction, so it's not a very efficient...
So they've just about gone beyond the break-even. Yes.
What are the benefits of fusion over fission then, John Griffin?
Well, I think the most important one is the absence of any radioactive waste products, which is the big bugbear with fission, that you have all this radioactive material to dispose of. And ideally, if you had a proper fusion reactor working, that you would start out with hydrogen, which you could get from seawater, as Jim says, and your waste product would be helium, which is, it's so far from being a problem, it's actually a desirable commercial product, so you could probably sell it as a byproduct of the activity.
I've read about something called cold fusion, which seems to be much less expensive and so on and so forth. It was claimed of two people in Southampton in 1989.
We're all screwing up our noses. Yeah,
there you go.
Cold fusion's a dream.
Cold fusion.
It's not quite like perpetual motion machines, but the idea is that through some process, you could persuade nuclei to fuse together without having very high temperatures, which is really what you need to make nuclei hit each other hard enough for the Velcro to stick, according to the conventional picture. And there were some suggestive experiments. I wouldn't go so far as to say persuasive, but there were some experiments that were done a couple of decades ago now, which seemed to show that energy was coming out from a system that was more than the energy being put in a cold, basically, in what you'd think of as a test tube, that using electric currents at more or less room temperature, you could somehow persuade things to stick together and get more energy out than was being put in. There are very few people who think that that's a correct interpretation of what was going on. There are a couple, and there is some sponsorship of this kind of research being carried out in Japan at a very low level, a low level of funding, which is worth doing because obviously if it does work, then it'll make somebody a huge pile of money, but it's not something that's taken very seriously.
It's worth mentioning that at the time, many nuclear physicists dropped what they were doing to look into this effect, and very quickly, almost back of the envelope calculations, realized that these people had to be out by a trillion, you know, 10 to the power 12 orders of magnitude, that you simply needed so many more neutrons to be produced.
Neutrons are a
byproduct of one of the types of fusion reactions.
Process that they were claiming, and they should have detected loads and loads of neutrons being produced.
In order to produce the sort of heat that they were claiming they'd seen.
Do you think that there's a stage, John Griffin, that the map has been laid out for nuclear physics? Are there many more things to be discovered? Are we, as we were, as it were, 100 years ago, a pre-plum pudding or just pushed onto another sort of plum pudding? Or?
It depends what you mean by nuclear physics. If you say, well, protons and neutrons explain things like fission and fusion and this liquid drop model and things like that, that's great. We understand it. We understand it as well as we understand atoms in terms of Bohr's work and so on. But if you say that nuclear physics includes what's inside protons and neutrons, then you're down to another level, and we're probing things like quarks, people may have heard of, which are supposed to lie inside protons and neutrons. And to some extent, you're back to this question of where do you stop probing, where do you stop finding new layers of truth to unravel.
And there's a strong force. I mean, the roots of the strong force that Jim mentioned, I mean, that's something that we really are trying to understand in terms of the constituents of protons and neutrons.
And another big area, of course, is that... We have only studied several hundred species of nuclei, or nuclides, with certain combination of protons and neutrons. It turns out that you can produce, if we think of Christine's Energy Valley picture, you can produce something like 6,000 or 7,000 or more species of nuclei. And we're just starting to study these. They're all unstable, they're radioactive, but they have a certain half-life, and they have very, very strange properties. And they can be used in nuclear medicine, they can be used in industry, they have tremendous applications. And it's only now that the technology is developed to produce these radioactive nuclei.
But do you think Einstein, we've only got a few minutes left, do you think Einstein was right and you would have been better off being a watchmaker and this whole adventure in nuclear physics hadn't started?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, there's two reasons. I mean, someone else would have done it, but I think the benefits do outweigh the costs. We've managed to avoid nuclear war and we've got a lot of benefit out of this stuff. And
such as, can you instance a few of
that? Well, I think nuclear power, though that's an emotive subject, I think in the long term we will have clean fusion power and it will be good for society, and the benefits from medicine. People very seldom appreciate how much benefit comes from radioactive materials
example.
In medicine. Dealing with tumours, cancer and so on, radiation therapy, things like the imaging that's done to look inside the body without invasive surgery, all of that comes from nuclear physics.
Magnetic resonance imaging, MRI scanners, used to be called nuclear magnetic resonance because it's a nuclear physics concept, but people dropped the word nuclear because they thought it had these negative connotations, but of course that's all nuclear physics.
I think the other thing is that it has helped us to understand the universe. And one of the things when Jim talked about fusion of elements in the sun is that, you know, we describe ourselves as carbon-based life forms. The carbon that's in all of us was created originally in the heart of a star. And I think that's a very sort of powerful concept and something that only we became aware of in the 20th century with nuclear physics.
So it's this way we can get back to the idea of origins, can we, John Grimmett?
Absolutely. I mean, this is very much my own pet area of interest, the relationship between ourselves, humankind, and the universe at large, and that we are products of the stars. We are absolutely, literally stardust.
I can't think of anything to say after that. Janitors, I feel quite exhausted having concentrated on that. It's been quite similar. Anyway, thank you all very much. Thanks, John Gribbin. Thanks, Jim Al-Khalili. Thank you to Christine Sutton. Next week, we're taking on the Cathars, the medieval heresy, the Cathars. There you go. Thanks for listening. Good morning.
In Our Time with Melvyn Bragg is produced by Charlie Taylor. Well, in a moment on 92 to 95 FM, our book of the week, Stan and Ollie, but first...
I am David of Bethlehem!
The rise and the fall of the first kingdom of Israel.
That is a shrine to our gods and I'll not blaspheme it!
Your gods are blasphemy!
History that still reverberates.
Every day our enemies are approaching, and every day I pray that the Lord will guide us.
We have defeated the Philistines before. We will do so again.
Ancient events that define today's Middle East. A new series of afternoon plays, Kings, begins on Tuesday at 2:15.
Our book of the week on FM in a moment's time, but on 198 Longwave now, the daily service introduced this morning by the Reverend Stephen Shipley. This is BBC Radio 4 FM. Now our book of the week. At the peak of their fame, 70 years ago, film comedians Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy enjoyed rather enormous public adulation.